This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane season starts tomorrow, and while forecasters are expecting an average season, it only takes one storm to devastate a community. Coming up, we'll hear from an emergency manager, a meteorologist, and the director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management about their preparations for hurricane season. Months after Hurricane Michael slammed the panhandle, rebuilding efforts continue. The devastation caused by that Category 5 storm is top of mind for emergency managers as they prepare for the 2019 season. Alan Harris is the emergency manager for Seminole County. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
How is Seminole County approaching this season as far as preparation goes?
So we like the forecast, and we certainly look at the forecast to identify the potential for hurricanes. But, of course, the forecasts don't say where the hurricanes will start, so we prepare for the worst. And we are right now planning a hurricane exercise, Category 5 hurricane coming in at the Brevard-Volusia County line, which would be our worst-case scenario. Basically, that would be Hurricane Michael that happened in the Panhandle, but it's happening to us.
Now, just explain the kind of dynamics of that. You're talking about a hurricane hitting right in the border of two other counties, but you're Seminole County, so why is that worst-case scenario for Seminole?
So when I was up in the Panhandle, I looked at the damage in Calhoun County, Gadsden County, Washington, Holmes. If people don't know where that is, that's actually further inland than Seminole is from the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of devastation there was basically Category 4 and Category 4 type of damage experienced there. So what that told me is that if Category 5 hurricane hit the coast along, again, the Brevard-Volusia County line, we'd be experiencing a Category 4 hurricane in Seminole County. And Irma was a tropical storm when it hit us. So it wasn't even a hurricane. It was Tropical Storm Irma. So the amount of damage would be exponentially worse with a Category 5 type hurricane.
When was the last time you were up in the Panhandle taking a look at that damage?
I was up there right prior to Hurricane Michael hitting, and then I stayed about a week afterwards working at the State Emergency Operations Center and then down in Bay County in Panama City.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back up probably about maybe about 3 months ago, and it's amazing the amount of debris that is still on the ground months and months later. I know that it took us months for debris to be picked up, and that is something we're trying to do this year, a little different than we did in Irma. It's something we learned in Irma, is we need to manage expectations a little better. Instead of having, we used to say have a 3-day worth of supplies, mm-hmm. we're now saying have about a week, because that's how long it took for most of the power to be restored. Some power even took 2 weeks from Tropical Storm Irma.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of debris that we had in Seminole County was 1 million cubic yards. That's 12.5 Spaceship Earth balls over at Epcot Center. So that's how much we picked up.
What's that in like dump trucks?
You're right. And that's why I had to do it. That's why I used the Epcot Center, mm-hmm. The Spaceship Earth, because yep. I didn't know what 1 million cubic yards. I don't know what that means. But when I look at that big structure and I said, wow, we picked up 12.5 of those of debris, that's amazing. And it takes months. So people thinking the garbage truck's going to come by and pick up all your debris, that is unrealistic. It's mm-hmm. not going to happen. It will take months for us to pick up debris. And in the Panhandle, as I said, it's still taking place right now.
Did Hurricane Michael rattle emergency managers in Florida? I mean, just sort of looking at what happened there and how quickly that storm brewed up to the strength it was when it came ashore?
Absolutely. It really called attention to how important it is to prepare well in advance of the event. So we've been doing that regularly since Hurricane Irma. We've been working on our after action items. We've been trying to prepare as best we can. We have the exercise, of course, that we're conducting, and those after action items will continue to enhance how we respond to disasters. We want to respond as best that we can. We want to be quick in our response and effective in our response. And we know that sometimes we don't have a lot of notice.
If you're new to the area, and we do have a lot of new arrivals in Florida every day, what's your recommendation? You're just coming in, hurricane season's about to start, you're not quite sure what to expect. What do you do?
Sure. Really, four things. One, get a plan. Know where you're going to go, know where you're going to evacuate, to contact those people now. Have your important telephone numbers listed down, your medications, things like that. In Florida, you can get a refill on your prescription before the storm hits, even if it's not your normal prescription time. So go ahead and get a refill of your prescription. Write all those prescriptions down. Get a kit together. And as I said just a little while ago, make sure that you have about 1 week's worth of supply in your disaster kit. Stay informed. There's lots of different ways to stay informed. Of course, the local radio station here. Listen to the radio station here. We have an electronic notification system. We encourage you to register for the local emergency management office wherever you live. Sign up for their alerting system so you can get evacuations and curfew information and things like that and when shelters are going to open. And then the fourth is to volunteer. We are in desperate need of volunteers pre and post-storm. So consider nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations, getting together and developing disaster teams that could help our community rebuild and become more resilient.
And if you're looking at what to put in your disaster kit, I mean, 7-day supply, like what kind of things should you have in there?
Sure. So we have a checklist on our preparedness website. It's called Prepare Seminole. And there's a lot of different other websites. You can go to Red Cross. They have some great ideas, some concepts. Non-perishable foods, clearly. Water, 1 gallon per person per day. Batteries, a portable radio. A lot of people have gone to using the iPhone, whatever your smart device is. But we say have a portable radio so you can actually listen to the local news right here and have that available to you. Flashlights, not candles. Some tools that you can clean up around the house right after, a tarp, things like that.
Now, there is also a tax holiday starting Friday. That's kind of a good thing, too. You can actually get out there and buy some of the stuff you should have in your kit.
Absolutely. So to encourage people to get prepared as we get into the hurricane season, the state of Florida has issued a tax-free holiday for disaster supplies, and it's from May 31st to June 6th. You can go to our website, and you can get a list of all the tax-free type items. There's an assortment of different types of items that you can purchase over the weekend and then into next week completely tax-free.
Alan Harris, one of the things we also hear from emergency managers and other officials is that the immediate aftermath of the storm is sometimes the most dangerous. Why would that be?
So after the disaster, unfortunately, that is when we experience most of our injuries and most of our deaths. And that was certainly the case up in Hurricane Michael. There are curfews issued for specific reasons. It's not because we want people to stay off the road just for fun. There's public safety concerns. The only loss of life that we had in 2004 were vehicle collisions after the storm because people didn't see the traffic signals. It was dark outside. In one case, an individual flipped their vehicle because there was potholes in the road. So that's the first time that people start to use their chainsaws. They turn on their generator and it's too close to the house. So those types of things, unfortunately, post-storm cause the most injuries and most deaths right after. So if you are going to use a chainsaw, learn how to do it prior to the storm. You know, if you do have a generator, make sure that you know where you're going to place it and place it well far away from your home.
And there's also a run on things like plywood, right? I mean, people just basically strip the shelves bare at hardware stores or basic grocery items like in the run-up to a storm. I guess the message would be try and get some of that stuff stashed away so you don't get caught up in the rush.
Right. We know that's going to be a news story. We know it. That right prior to a hurricane, that is absolutely one of the news stories, the huge long lines, the people waiting, and the no supplies. Why wait for that? This tax-free holiday is a good way to go ahead and just do those things right now. And you don't have to buy them all at once. You know, I didn't do that. Instead, over time, I've bought some things for my disaster kit. I have a really nice disaster kit. I'm not even going to be home. I'm going to be at the Emergency Operations Center. But I probably had the best disaster kit in the entire neighborhood. And it's just because I continue to add things. Each time I go to the grocery store, each time I go to the hardware store, I buy a couple extra items.
Okay, so you've got a pretty big operation coming up. A lot of agencies involved. Do you do this every year?
We do a hurricane exercise each year. This year, it's going to be a little larger than in previous. Because of some of the things that we've learned from Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Michael, this year we will activate an emergency shelter to the point of opening it up.
And this is a way for you guys to kind of iron out any of the possible wrinkles in the system before the big one hits.
Exactly. We want to test every memorandum of understanding. We want to make sure that everyone that is out in the field that we have said will do certain activities, that they are set and ready to go for hurricane season. All the generators are ready to go. Everything that we say that all year long we've been planning for, we want to make sure it's ready to go right now.
Alan Harris is the Seminole County Emergency Manager. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, we'll hear from the Director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Jared Moskowitz. But first, how the storm season looks from the meteorologist's desk. We paid a visit to Spectrum News 13 in downtown Orlando.
I'm Brian Carrick, and I'm the Chief Meteorologist at Spectrum News 13.
And we are in the News 13 Weather Center, which is downtown Orlando. Just describe a little bit for our listeners where we're standing and what you have going on here?
We actually have a separate weather studio from the main news studio, which kind of gives us the ability to move around a little bit more. With five full-time meteorologists on staff, we actually have plenty of space to have our staff set up so that if we're covering hurricanes or any severe weather, we can put ourselves at various spots. We're standing in the middle of our weather center right now, looking at our green screen, a couple of dual monitors, and our main desk.
And I guess hurricane season got off to a bit of an early start with the first named storm coming before we even got started into hurricane season proper. Does that make you a little bit nervous, Brian?
Well, it's interesting because for the past 5 years, we've actually had named storm before the season actually kicks off. And although last season was pretty busy overall, and everybody remembers Hurricane Michael here in the panhandle of Florida, the season itself really isn't based on what we're going to see before the season starts. It just it kind of depends on a number of factors. And this year we're looking at some factors like abnormally warm or above average temperatures in the sea out across the tropical Atlantic as well as the tropical Caribbean, and an increase in the monsoon season and monsoon storms that come off the coast of Africa. Those are a couple of factors playing in, but we also have a weak El Nino. So the two might be able to play off each other. And overall, the system, subtropical storm Andrea, doesn't really bear what we are going to be looking at for the rest of this season. The factors I described really do.
So meteorology 101, warm ocean is bad because that means you're going to get more and stronger storms, but the El Nino could kind of make those storms break up quicker?
Well, the sea surface temperatures should be about 80 degrees or higher. That is some high-octane fuel. As you get warmer and warmer into the 80s, it really fuels the hurricane and lets it build. Aloft with a weak El Nino, winds aloft are going to be just a little stronger than they typically would be. And what that will do is counter the storm from being able to breathe, and that's going to take the storm and kind of tear it apart on top. So we've got the factors of the wind aloft, but the sea surface temperatures kind of, again, almost evening out, and we'll see how storms are able to handle that.
Have you guys kind of ramped up your weather coverage in recent years? Like, as far as the team you have now, is that a bigger team than you've ever had here?
We have had a team of five for years. Our team currently, though, of five, with the certifications that we have, continuing education, and the importance that we put into weather at Spectrum News 13, we have ramped up our coverage. We've come into coverage of hurricanes as a team with a motto: don't be scared, just be prepared. So we've taken as a team a motto that really puts us kind of in a calmer mindset, taking us through storm season. So yes, we're ramping up the coverage, but that coverage is a little deeper. We're explaining more. We're giving people more of a heads up and the opportunity to prepare.
Do you think when people are, you know, several days out from a storm and they're looking at spaghetti models, that can induce a little bit of fear or panic sometimes? Like, how do you go about explaining, like, this is a potential storm track, it's not the only one, there are plenty of things to be aware of here?
Sure. You know, there are so many models that we look at daily, and when we share the spaghetti models on air, spaghetti models are giving us a look at all the various models that we would be using, and it's kind of like throwing spaghetti up against a map, looking at it, just kind of going all over the place, and yeah, it makes people nervous. It really does. But they like to see that. They want to see the probabilities. But what we do is we pick through the spaghetti models and we find a couple models that we really rely on, and that's what we focus on. So we try and pull that panic out by showing what we think is going to be the most reliable models to use.
So how many storm seasons have you been a weather forecaster here for?
I've been four seasons here in Orlando, but back in 2004, I was actually in Orlando to help cover Hurricanes Francis and Jean. So that kind of gave me a good opportunity to dig into my hurricane expertise and learning over the years. And then prior to moving to Orlando 4 years ago, studying up on hurricanes and how to actually look through the hurricane to kind of figure out what exactly is in it has given me a pretty good heads up on what to expect. And with 4 years under our belt, we've had from everything from Hurricane Matthew to Hurricane Irma here in Central Florida. Obviously, we continue to hone those skills and really kind of keep people informed.
How much has prediction changed in those 4 years you've been here? Like, how good is the science now compared to when you were starting out here?
There's still a lot of work to do, a lot of improvement in the models, but they continue to tweak the models, and they've become a little more robust. I'm noticing that just in the past 4 years, I can pick a certain time that a model will come out, a particular time that, especially in the I'd say evening hours, a model comes out that it's going to be a little more robust, a little more reliable. So I've learned that. But the models continue to be tweaked. But over the past 4 years, we've had a considerable amount of improvement. Not only that, but in Doppler radar and the use of Doppler radar when these storms are actually coming in.
Do you yourself go out and do any live coverage from the field during storms?
We do not here at Spectrum News 13. We keep our weather experts in-house. The thought behind that is that we want our technology being used to keep the people safe, to actually explain better and to show what's going on. If we're standing out in the field, yes, we're showing the storm moving in, but we're not actually utilizing our technology that we have, our live radar, our graphics systems, and to really show what's going on. We want to be here in the weather center, and so we will put our reporters in the field to cover the storm itself.
I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the notion of a meteorologist standing out, you know, when a storm's coming in, kind of being blown sideways. It seems like there's a little bit of theater involved in that. Is it valuable for viewers to see something like that, do you think?
It is kind of theater. I mean, obviously last year we had a meteorologist from the Weather Channel who was out in the field, and he was blowing around, or so it appeared, that he was about ready to tip over, but people strolled behind him without any issue. That is a little more of a theater to it. The reporters that we put in the field, we put them in a safe spot, so we won't stick them out in that strong wind because it does no good to show people that. People may see that and be drawn to some of those images, but then there are those who realize how unintelligent it is to stand out with winds that are over 100 miles per hour and there's debris flying around. So we want to make sure that when we put our reporters out there, they are in a safe place. We'll put them in a concrete structure or under some sort of a structure that will keep them from whipping around in that wind with all that debris.
There are always going to be some residents who, no matter what they're told by authorities, they'll just decide to ride it out. What have you kind of seen and encountered in your time as a meteorologist here as far as people deciding to say, I think I'm good in my house, I can hang out here? And what are your thoughts on the merits of that approach?
We will always have those who don't want to evacuate, they don't want to leave their property, and I can understand to a point that, you know, you're leaving your possessions behind, you're leaving your home, maybe you grew up in that home, maybe you've lived there for years and you're leaving that behind, so it's really difficult to make that decision to leave. But what people need to understand is that leaving is the best thing, and it's, if you were asked to evacuate, do so. We have a lot of people who just refuse, and unfortunately they're putting their lives at risk, but they're also putting first responders' lives at risk when it comes to being able to get out to save them if something goes wrong. So the evacuation orders should be taken seriously. Those who are sticking around and they're kind of being stubborn. Yes, Irma slid to the west, kind of through central Florida and turned west. Matthew came up the coast, so people were kind of, well, do I evacuate? Do I not evacuate? If you're asked to, do so. Because if anything, just think of the first responders who are out there putting themselves at risk to help you.
Brian Carrick is the chief meteorologist for Spectrum News 13 in Orlando. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for allowing me to come in with you.
Up next, a conversation with Florida's new director of emergency management, Jared Moskowitz. Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist Jeff Huffman caught up with Moskowitz at the Governor's Hurricane Conference earlier this month.
I'm here at the annual Governor's Hurricane Conference, where attendance is notably up this year. Might have something to do with the last 2 years being years with major hurricane landfalls in the state of Florida. One of the busiest mans here at the conference is our new Director of Emergency Management, Jared Moskowitz. Jared, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me. You're just fresh on the job, 7 months in. What are some of the visions and changes or improvements you're looking to make with the department?
We're making a number of improvements. I mean, the first improvement that we've made is getting the reimbursement dollars out to cities and counties and applicants faster than ever before, not just for Irma, but obviously also for Hurricane Michael. Turning on the expedited program was an improvement that we made because that actually got dollars in advance to cities and counties, houses of worship, school boards, rather than waiting for a year for reimbursement. Because the finance piece to responding and recovering has become more important than ever. We're looking at our logistics program. We're looking at housing. Those are two key areas in response that we're focusing on so that we can actually stand up and supply temporary/permanent housing to disaster survivors that are in desperate need of those solutions.
And what about the federal money? I know there's been some delays in getting that. The folks in the Panhandle are certainly still hurting. How have you or your team stepped in?
Well, you know, there was a slight more delay with Irma federal dollars. I think the Michael federal dollars are flowing pretty fast from the public assistance side. And that is the reimbursement side, the expedited side. As soon as it comes to us, we're getting it out the door. And FEMA's been obligating it on a regular basis. I think the fact that we were able to get 100% funding for the first 45 days, 90% funding thereafter, is going to be a huge sigh of relief to the folks in the Panhandle and the rest of the state, frankly, because that's money that's now back in our state budgets. It's back in the county budgets, back in the city budgets. It's going to save over $1 billion to the state of Florida between the 45 days at 100% and the 90% reimbursement there forward. So, I think mostly the aggravation is on the supplemental that has not passed in Congress. We've six months now since the storm. There's no excuse that Congress has not passed that supplemental. Everybody knows it's a political game that is going on up there. Everything has now become political. You know, it used to be that emergency management and responding to storms and disasters of all kinds was not political, but now not even that is off limits. It's succumbed to the atmosphere of the moment. And so, we're hoping that that happens soon. We've seen some movement in the House, some movement maybe in the Senate negotiations. So perhaps that'll pass soon. The president will sign it.
And I've got to ask, since you are relatively young, maybe you don't remember Hurricane Andrew in 1992. What was your reaction when you first drove into Bay or Gulf counties in the wake of Hurricane Michael?
Well, I was there, you know, right after the storm had passed, and I had not seen anything like that since Katrina. It was Katrina-esque looking. I remember this, the complete devastation. You got to Mexico Beach, and it was just slabs. You know, the sea had come in and just taken everything with it. I remember the smell. I remember the sound, which was all of the smoke detectors from all of these houses that were going off. It was eerie.
And you only have to drive up and down I-10, which is 50, 60 miles inland from the coast, to see the devastating effects a major hurricane can have for inland areas. I mean, what would you tell residents of Gainesville, Ocala, or Orlando?
Oh, you watch that eye from Hurricane Michael, and you will see that eye come ashore, and you will see that eye stay almost completely intact until it got all the way into Georgia, which is why it caused all that vegetative damage in the state of Georgia. And so this idea that, oh, the hurricane winds and the strongest winds are only so far out from the eye, and depending upon how large the storm is, we might not get hurricane-force winds. Yeah, that might be true, but those winds may stay intact for 100-plus miles all the way inland.
You've been a very vocal proponent of improving communication after Hurricane Michael. There were certainly some challenges. How are you overcoming those for future storms?
Yeah, so we've already, done all the communications changes that we're going to make. We brought in all the telecom companies, and we said, listen, we don't need to do the blame game, but we all know that, the communications issue was a complete flop. And so, we all remember, after Wilma, the big challenge was power, 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 power. Well, the power companies got their act together, and they were fantastic after Michael. Now, the telecom companies took their hit, and what I think they've realized, really, is for the first time that telecommunications cell phone service is a life, health, safety issue. And I think you're going to see a dramatic different response. God forbid we ever have another event like that.
So one of the biggest challenges with Irma 2 years ago, the big story following that storm was the gas and the shortages of gas. How has your team continued to make improvements in that area?
Yeah, so we're working with DMS, the Department of Management Services that has fuel contracts, but we're going to be going out and doing our own fuel contract. We're going to be looking for separate fuel vendors. One of the biggest challenges is that everybody goes to the same folks looking for gas. And so we're trying to really expand that pool of folks so that we can bring more fuel in from the state if the folks inside are tapped out. We've talked about, strategic reserves, perhaps. I know that's something that's been floated around, making sure that we know the pipeline access, being able to have access to our ports is a huge deal, and then, making sure that the roads are clear so we can get that fuel in.
Thank you so much for your time, Jared. That was Jared Moskowitz, the new Director of Emergency Management for the state of Florida. For the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network in West Palm, I'm Jeff Hoffman.
Still to come on Intersection, Adam Troy Castro has published 27 books and counting. Talk to the veteran author about science fiction, horror, and writing for kids, and what keeps him motivated after all those books. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. South Florida author Adam Troy Castro has published 27 books and counting. He writes science fiction, horror, and books for kids, and he's in Orlando this weekend at the Orlando Area Science Fiction Society's annual convention. He stopped by the studio to talk about what inspires his writing and what keeps him motivated. Adam Troy Castro, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
You don't stick to just one genre. You're a prolific writer, and you've written fantasy, you've written sci-fi, you've written horror.
Children's books.
Children's books, too, and a bunch of short stories, too. So tell me about the process of switching from one genre to another.
Well, the process is really not to worry about what category the story is going to be in before you start writing it. You write the story, and then you discover that it is a horror story or a superhero story or whatever else it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is a way that you prevent your body of work from getting stale, from always being the same thing.
Now, you won an award from the Analog Analytical Laboratory, the 2018 Analog Analytical Laboratory Award. It was for a short story, The Unnecessary Parts of the Story.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, that was a story which is from the point of view of an alien contagion, talking about how little movies and stories like Alien make sense because the characters are always doing the stupidest possible thing. And I wanted to come up with an explanation for that. And in this story, there is a universal explanation for that.
That's kind of a trope that you find in horror movies too, right? The characters
Absolutely.
Do things that make you want to yell at the screen, don't open that door or something.
To a certain extent, that is required because in those movies, you want the audience to see ahead of the characters. No, don't do that. Mm-hmm. Don't go there. Don't climb those stairs. Don't go in that basement. Don't turn your back on the killer.
Do you find yourself, you kind of write some of those tropes into your stories too?
I do, and I have actually lived them. To some extent. Many years ago, visiting a friend, I walked into a dark house and calling that friend's name, and I was three or four flights upstairs from the front door before I realized that somewhere in some universe, there were about 500 people in an audience, auditorium somewhere, yelling at me for being so incredibly stupid for being there. I think the main thing is that you don't realize you're in a movie. These characters do not realize they're in a horror story. Otherwise, they'd be a lot more on edge.
Back to your output. I mean,
it's 27 books as of this point, including the latest collection, which is called "And Other Stories," which is from Skyboat Media, and that's all stories in audio, including one which is a short radio drama.
So that's. I mean, that's prolific.
Excuse me one second. It's 150 short stories as of this point.
Wow. So that's a lot. You've got a massive body of work. How do you keep motivated churning out this much material?
It helps that it's something I love to do. One thing they should tell you about writing a story, it's also discovering the story. You may know what's going to happen, but you still discover all the details along the way. And you are your first audience, so you're entertaining yourself, or you're making yourself laugh, or you're making yourself frightened. If you're not frightened by a story yourself while writing it, it's not going to be a frightening story. Similarly, if you're not laughing at it out loud, it's not going to be a funny story.
Mm-hmm.
You need to please yourself first.
Have you ever been too afraid of a story or what might happen to finish it? Have you got some unfinished horrors in the vault there?
Oh, I have more fragments than I could possibly tell you. But I can tell you, as I have come to the end or near the end of some stories, I have realized to my horror that a certain character I really like is going to die or might die. And when that's happening and I'm really worried about it, that's a sign that the audience is going to be the same way. The reader is going to also be as concerned.
Now, tell me about Gustav Gloom.
Gustav Gloom is a little boy about 10 years old who was an orphan and was raised by shadows in a haunted house. Not ghosts, but shadows. And the books are written from the point of view of the little girl named Fernie Watt, who moves in across the street and becomes his best friend. And between them, they fight a lot of supernatural horrors and ultimately save the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there are six novels in the series. The first one is Gustav Gloom and the People Taker. And although every book is complete in and of itself, it is a saga that eventually will come to a conclusion in the last book, which was published a couple of years ago.
So what kind of response have you gotten from that particular audience, your younger readers?
Well, I can tell you that it's the most heartening thing that I have ever experienced in my career. I have spoken via Skype to classrooms all over the world. I spoke with a classroom in Bali. I've spoken to classrooms in London. I mean, all across the United States. I've done some of this from the comfort of my own home, and I've done some of it traveling and visiting various classrooms. And I can tell you there is nothing more rewarding than seeing children whose passion for reading has been kindled by these books. I've talked to a few kids who had never read a book before. Now, when a kid tells you it's the best book I've ever read, statistically it doesn't mean that much. Emotionally it does.
Is there some overlap between the different genres you work in, like horror or science fiction?
There's a lot of overlap. Basically, science fiction has a lot of scary stories, and a lot of horror stories have a scientific explanation. The difference is really what the thrust of the story is, what the emotional thrust of the story is. The unknown is always a scary thing, but I think one very glib way of putting it is that in a horror story, you don't want to know what's behind the door, and in a science fiction story, you generally do, and you send robots in there to find out for you.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the original horror stories, right, Frankenstein, is also a science fiction story.
Absolutely. She's the mother of science fiction and of horror at the same time.
So tell me about the convention you'll be speaking at this weekend. What can audiences expect there?
Well, the Oasis Science Fiction Convention has been going on for about 30 years. Some of these conventions have memberships going into the tens of thousands of people. This will be a few hundred. And this is where enthusiasts go to meet the authors, to play role-playing games. There will be some cosplay. There'll be a dealer's room. There'll be an art show. A man called Paul Vincenti is coming up with a Game of Thrones exhibit, including a Iron Throne. I don't know if this is an Iron Throne that people will be allowed to sit in. I can guarantee you they will fight over it.
Just like the TV series.
Hopefully not with the same body count.
So do you enjoy meeting your readers?
It's delightful. Writing is the most lonely job there is, short of being a deep sea diver. It's a very lonely job because you get up in the morning and you're facing a blank of some kind, a blank screen or a blank piece of paper, depending on the level of technology you're using. And it's basically you and the possibilities. And you need that in order to compose a story, but I can tell you that the feedback, when it comes, is wonderful.
I'm sure there's going to be some aspiring writers or published writers at this convention as well who'll be keen to talk to you. What kind of advice would you have to someone who's looking to get into the science fiction genre and get their work published?
Well, the most basic piece of advice I give to any writer is you can't be a writer if you're not a reader. I encounter this all the time. I don't really like to read, but I want to write a book. I have a great idea for a book, and it'll be an automatic bestseller, of which there is no such thing. But the non-readers imagine there is. And I can tell you that you don't become a good writer unless you see what the standards are, unless you see what the various techniques are, what the tropes are, and unless you get the rhythm of stories down pat. And it doesn't take all that much. I know a guy who decided he wanted to be a writer and spent 5 years on a speed reading kick. He read about 100 thrillers, then wrote one, and then wrote another one after that. And he sold them. He was doing quite well. And most writers are very active readers from a very young age. And again, the first step is to love being part of the audience yourself.
And then write a lot.
Yeah. I'm also fond of talking about Ernest Hemingway, who very famously said that you have to write 1 million bad words before you write your first good one. He was very famous for throwing his first manuscript, once it was completed, off shipboard into the Atlantic Ocean.
Sounds a bit dramatic.
He said you have to do that. I did not do that, but I might as well have because my first few are still in a drawer somewhere.
Well, Adam Troy Castro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, part two from our live taping of the Tiny Desk Contest local favourites at the Abbey from earlier this month. We'll hear from Blackberry when Intersection returns. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to continue now with our Tiny Desk local favourites recorded live at the Abbey in Orlando earlier this month.
Welcome back to Intersection, our live Tiny Desk local favourites performance. I want to welcome Blackberry to the stage. And just tell us a little bit about the first song you're going to play.
So, the first song I'm going to play is called Monkey on My Back. Me and Alberto, we wrote and arranged it together. We met at Full Sail. He's from Panama. I'm from Chicago. And we just melted the song together. It just worked out, you know? It just worked out.
All right, when you're ready.
Thank you.
Alberto Rodriguez Cespedes on bass, Ebire Sofia mm-hmm. on vocals,
yes,
and Andres Ochoa on drums. So tell me a little bit about how you met and how you kind of formed, because you are from very different places.
Yes, so I go to Full Sail University, and I was on the Full Sail University page, and I was like, I need a band member to join me so we can make music together. I need like a live band. So that's what I did. I found Alberto. That's how we met each other.
Funny enough, sometimes you meet those people that you simply make those musical connections. I'm glad to say that this is one of those. And also, my dear friend right here, she's an old bandmate, actually, that for coincidences of life, here we are. I hope you enjoy your show.
So, Ebiri, tell me a little bit about your influences. There's quite a lot going on here. There's a very kind of soulful flavor to the music, a lot of Latin tones as well. How do you blend that all together?
So it's so funny because we actually have similar musical interests. So he likes a lot of bands. I like a lot of bands. I like Lauryn Hill and the Fugees. He liked Lauryn Hill and the Fugees. That was one of the things that we connected on. So just a couple of artists like that. He's really into rock and a lot of rock bands, and he kind of showed me and introduced me more into the rock band world, and I showed him more about R&B. So ever since, we've been rocking on together in a band.
Did you grow up performing? Did you have a lot of musical influences as a kid?
So actually, when I grew up in Chicago, and I used to go to music festivals because we're big on those. So I just have a background in choir. I did theater. I did dance. And my mom, she's in dance classes. She's always performing. And so that kind of runs in my mom's side of the family. And on my dad's side of the family, they're from Nigeria. And I have apparently I just found this out. I have a bunch of musicians on my dad's side of the family. So I guess it just runs in the family.
What kind of music did you listen to growing up? Like, did you raid your parents' records collection?
Yes, my dad had a huge record collection. He had a huge record collection, and he ended up keeping some and giving some away, but I listened to a lot of Afrobeat, R&B, roots and reggae. That was pretty much it, Afrobeat, R&B, roots and reggae, and that's what I was really raised on listening to.
Mm-hmm. Alberto, what about yourself? What kind of music were you listening to as a kid?
As a kid, I listened to a lot of Lauryn Hill, Dusty's, R&B. I listened to a lot of rap. Anything that was on regular mainstream radio, I was listening to mainstream.
Mm-hmm. And Alberto?
In my case, since I'm the youngest of four, I always had the influence of everybody in the household, but mostly since my older brothers were always playing rock albums, my dad on his side was playing reggae and also Pindin, which is like a derivative from cumbia, if from Panama. Mm-hmm. For myself, I started to dig a lot what it was, the alternative music, specifically into the weirder side of music, like chicha, a little bit more into indie rock. I mean, all over the place. When you're the youngest of four, mm-hmm. you just hear everything that your brothers expose you to.
So tell me about the process of recording for Tiny Desk. Like, what was it that made you want to apply for it, and how did you come about, you know, deciding this was the song you wanted to record?
Well, Abby, how will you say?
Well, we both watched NPR Tiny Desk, and he told me about it. So I was like, okay, let's do it, because we pretty much record all of our rehearsals anyway. So it was all his mastermind plan. I was just down for it, and it ended up working out.
Thank you.
And what's next for you all? Where do you see Blackberry going next?
Just exploring my sound some more. A bit of R&B. I produce a little bit on the side, and I just think that we're going to keep working on covers. What do you think?
Watch out for an EP soon. Watch out.
Real soon. Coming soon.
So, Ebieri, what about the next song you're going to perform for us?
So, the next song is kind of just like a medley, because we never completely finish it, but it turned into a nice arrangement, like with the three songs together. It's called Have It Your Way.
All right. Take it away.
One, two, three. 3, 4. Hey. Don't you go if you don't wanna go. I mean, don't you go, don't you go. Don't you go if you don't wanna go. Don't you go, don't you go, don't you go, don't you go. If you wanna go, you can go. Yeah. Please don't you go away from me. Please don't you go. You can go. Don't you go if you don't wanna go. I mean, don't you go, don't you go. Don't you go if you don't wanna go. Don't you go. You can go if you wanna go. You can go if you wanna go. I'll be here, I'll be right here.
Thank you.
Well, Blackberry, Ebieri Sofia, Andres Ochoa, and Alberto Rodriguez Cespedes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
That performance from Orlando group Blackberry was recorded earlier this month at the Abbey in downtown Orlando. Blackberry was one of the groups that submitted a video for NPR's Tiny Desk contest. You can watch all of those entries over on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Thank you.